Hey everyone, this is Josh, host of the Urban Valor Podcast. Today's guest is Marine veteran Savannah Cannon. Savannah grew up in a small town on a farm in Georgia. She had a very traumatic childhood and became suicidal as a teenager. Savannah enlisted in the Marine Corps to escape her unfortunate childhood. She was 20 years old when she deployed to Afghanistan in 2010. While on her combat deployment, Savannah experienced harsh treatment, which began immediately upon her arrival to Afghanistan. She was greeted by a major who told her, "You're a girl, you're not supposed to be here," and advised her to stay away from the men. She had to endure retaliation for rejecting sexual advances. Savannah eventually found writing as a form of therapy and leaves us with how her experience affected her mental health upon transitioning back into the civilian world. If you enjoyed this episode, go give us a 5-star rating and leave a comment to help support our veterans. The bigger the community, the bigger the impact. If you'd like to contribute your story to Urban Valor, know anyone else who may, reach out on Instagram at Urban Valor TV, or you can email me at josh@urbanvalor.com. Enjoy the show.
I'm Savannah Cannon, and I was in the United States Marine Corps for 5 years, and I left as a sergeant. I served from 2007 to 2012. I grew up in a small town in Georgia on a farm. I was the youngest of seven, steps and halves, and I was kind of alone my entire childhood. I mainly read and kept to myself or worked on the farm. We had cows and a bunch of acreage, and I would just wander around and kind of be alone. And I didn't want to be around the majority of my family. The majority of my siblings were a lot older than me. At the end, it was just me and my sister, who was 5 years older than me, who were around. I had not a great childhood, very much. My mom had gotten divorced from my biological father. He was a drug addict and abusive and awful to her. And so she left him and married the man who would later adopt me, who was also extremely abusive. And he hit me all the time with all sorts of items, be it like spoons or belts. He would actually fashion a wooden paddle in his workshop. And my name was on one side of it and my sister's name was on the other. And every time he beat us with it, we had to write what we were getting hit for and the date. And my sister had like one thing on her side. And I had just multiple lines of my name. It was covered with the things that I had gotten in trouble for, because I stood up against him a lot. And that wasn't something he approved of. How he wanted us to behave was to be seen and not heard. Raised extremely religiously. So the idea of spare the rod, spoil the child was something that they believed in. He would make me go pull switches off the tree to hit me with also. It wasn't just me that, you know, got in trouble. My mom and him fought all the time. They fought about money a lot because we were pretty poor. My dad always wanted, I call him my dad. He was my stepfather who adopted me and was the man who raised me, so I call him my dad. But he always wanted his hobby stuff, right? He always wanted the cars and the motorcycles and the boats, and he was a pilot in his spare time. So there was always money for his toys, but there wasn't money for us to eat. There was one time, you know, I was doing dishes. I think I was 8 years old, 7 or 8 years old, and I was doing dishes, and it was this yellow pan that had a lot of like scrapings on it, and I was scraping the bottom of it. He was wondering why I was taking so long to do the dishes, and he started screaming at me for doing the dishes, and my mom stepped in to defend me. And that night was one of the biggest fights that I saw them have, because she had defended me. My sister and I like would stay at the top of the stairs and listen in on, you know, the fights as kids do. And he was just awful, the things that he said to her and about her and about us and how awful children we were. But my sister and I fell asleep. And then I think it was, you know, in the middle of the night at some point, I wake up to my mom pulling me out of the bed and dragging me into my sister's room. And we were all three of us huddled on the bed. And I could hear my dad downstairs screaming, "I swear to God, Claire, if you don't come down here, I'd do it. I swear I'll do it." She's screaming and crying and she's trying to go, and we're holding her back from going down the stairs. And then we hear a gunshot, and then the front door slams, so we know that he's still alive. He left and went over to his workshop where he always worked on all of his like toys and stuff, and we ran to, you know, their bedroom to look out, to watch him walking away, holding the gun. You know, my mom's sitting there crying, not knowing what to do. And I'm, like I said, 8, and my sister's 13 at this time. And I'm just sitting there like reassuring her, it'll be okay. It's all right. And then like, I turn around and look, and he's coming back to the house, and I'm like screaming. And I don't know what happened after that. Like, I don't remember what happened. I think we like left and slept on the floor of the middle school cafeteria where my mom worked, on like, you know, those red rugs that night, and came back, and he had shot the TV, which is an odd thing to focus your anger on. That would just be one of many incidences over my childhood where he would exert violence and intimidation. He kicked a hole in the refrigerator. He threw his wedding ring through one of the windows. It was a double pane window, so it didn't go through the second one. So for years, that window was broken, and his wedding ring was at the bottom of the hole where in between the two panes. So yeah, I really didn't like being in that house, like, at all. I read all the time. The lesser punishments I would get would be to be grounded from reading. I wasn't allowed to read. And then as soon as I could, I started working. I started helping my mom clean houses when I was 13. And then from there, I started working like under the table in a restaurant when I was, I think, 14 or 15, because we were too poor to really afford food. And so I knew that if I wanted to, you know, do anything, I needed to be able to pay for it myself. And so I started making money and then giving that money to my mom to be able to make dinner and stuff. So I was working 40 hours by the time I was 15 years old, 40 hours a week plus going to school. And I played soccer. I was in the band. I don't think I slept from the time I was like probably 8, because I was just so busy. Being busy and being away was the way that I, you know, kind of survived. A lot of my dad's abuse changed how I interacted with people in general. He would call me a piece of shit. He would call me lazy. And, you know, one of the nicknames he would call me is Tissue, because working on the farm, he said every single time there would be work to be done, it'd be like a tissue blowing in the wind, because I would just be off trying to be away from them because I didn't want to get, you know, yelled at for days. And I was dating a guy who really wanted to join the Marine Corps. And I was like, oh, this sounds okay. And he, like, my dad, I think, laughed at me and said, you know, you're never going to make it. And I was like, boy, fuck you. I'm going to make it. Like, I'm going to go, and don't tell me I can't do something. There was a time I was like, I think I'm going to be like vegetarian. And he like laughed and was like, nah, I'll talk to you in a year. You're not going to be able to do that. And so like a year later, I went to him and I was like, well, guess what? Guess who has been a vegetarian for a year? He's like, what? Didn't even remember that. Like, he would just make off the hand comments that, you know, would impact me for a long time, because it would stick in my head. But so he said, no, you're never going to be able to succeed. And so I forged my parents' signatures and I left at 17 because I wasn't going to be there. More stuff happened. Like, when I was a teenager, by the time I was like 11, I realized that my older stepbrother had molested me. It, like, I was having some sort of breakdown, and like, it just slammed back into my like brain. Is like, oh my God, this actually, because I actually realized what it was, you know, like what it, like the context, like I was a little bit older and I was like, oh my God, that's what happened. And I was not okay when I was a teenager. I tried to kill myself the first time when I was 11, when I realized that that's what had been done to me. They didn't kick him out of the family at all. When I graduated boot camp and I went back, there was a family reunion, and they made me sit next to him at the table. And my grandmother pulled me aside, and she was like, I know, you know, what happened, but sometimes as women, we just have to, you know, accept that this is how things are, and we must push forward in order to get through it. My parents were so focused on the fact that I was fucked up. My mom tried to like get me help, right? I got sent to a bunch of psychiatrists and stuff, and I was put on Prozac when I was 11, which was not approved, by the way, for use in children. And that made it worse. Like, the suicide ideations got worse. And then they diagnosed me as bipolar and put me on a bunch of antidepressant and anti-seizure medications. The same guy that wanted or said the Marine Corps thing, when he was dating me, he was like, you're like a zombie. Like, you have no emotion. You don't like do anything. Because every single time I would laugh or cry, my parents would be like, have you taken your medicine? So I wasn't allowed to like laugh or cry. And when my boyfriend said that, I was like, I don't want to be like this anymore. I don't know what it's like to like feel emotions. So I stopped taking the medicine cold turkey, which is not what you're supposed to do at all. And then overdosed. Took all of the Lamictal and Celexa that I had stored up to try to be normal, to try to be the fun person that he had said I wasn't. And it turns out that if you haven't been able to feel emotions during your formative teenage years, like I had been medicated from the time I was 11, jumping from medicines too, jumping from Prozac to all the other like weird things that were not FDA approved for children at that time. You haven't been able to feel those emotions, and all of a sudden you go cold turkey on these antidepressants and anti-seizure medications, because that's what Lamictal is an anti-seizure. Because they thought that like, I don't know, bipolar was some sort of mini brain seizures, and so they thought that Lamictal would help. It doesn't go well when all of a sudden you feel all these emotions. It was a mixture of everything from being molested to being beaten to being psychologically like tortured, it felt like, in my own home, because people at school didn't know what was going on. Like I said, I was a straight A student. I was beyond reproach in everything that I did and a functioning member of society. And then all of a sudden I was in ICU for having, you know, tried to kill myself. And after a 72-hour psychiatric hold when I was 16, and I remember being in like the mental hospital, like 16, right? And it's awful. You're behind all these locked doors. And I looked around at like the people that were there and I was like, oh my God, these people are actually crazy. I'm not crazy. Like I'm just, they make you do like group sessions. And looking back now, it was Atlanta, right? So I bet a lot of people were just also not supported by their families, caught up in drugs, caught up in bad situations also. And that was the state of like the mental hospital. It was state mandated by Georgia that I would see a psychologist. So I actually got to go in and talk to someone for the first time with no one around, just me and, you know, this man who was probably in his 60s. And like, I'm probably like 2 months into this treatment. And he looks at me and he's like, you're not bipolar at all. He's like, you are reacting to, you know, this like situation that you're around. It was the first person who ever spoke up for me, because he brought my mom in and he's like, the problem is not her. It is you and your marriage and what it's doing to her. Like my dad would do so much fucked up stuff. So he used to hit me all the time, right? With anything he can get his hands on. One day he pulled me into the bedroom and he was like, he locked it behind him and he was like, we're going to play a joke on your mom. All right, I'm going to take this belt and I'm going to beat the bed as much as I can. And you're going to scream like you're being, you know, beaten. I'm like, okay. Like I really enjoyed, like I wanted to please my dad, right? Like I'd do anything to get him to remotely say that I was a good kid or anything. Not that he ever did, but I was constantly wanting that. So I'm like, yeah, okay, I'll do this. So he pulls off the belt and starts beating the bed, and I start screaming like I'm being beaten. And my mom is on the other side of the bedroom door, throwing her body up against it. That was his idea of a joke. And being a parent now, I'm like, I can't imagine doing that to my significant other or my child. I went to school once and I had welts up and down the back of my leg. And someone saw it and the school counselor pulled me in and was like, are you getting hit? And I'm like, yeah, like, duh. Isn't everyone getting hit? Like, isn't that like a constant thing? And she was like, no, that's not what happens. And so they called Child Protective Services. They called it like DFAS or something, Defensive Family and in Georgia. So they came out and they, when my parents were notified that they were coming out, it got worse, because my dad was like, if you don't lie to them, you're going to be taken away and you're going to be raped all the time and you're going to, like, things are going to get bad for you. So you better fucking lie to them. And so the investigator came out and I was like, no, I'm not hit. I don't get hit. You know, I was lying to the counselor. And so nothing happened. But then was it a couple, like maybe 2 months later, there was an article in the newspaper. There was a trailer park down the road from us. A dad had taken his three children. They were 3, 5, and 9, I think. And he had locked them in the trailer and set the trailer on fire. and killed them all. And my dad cut out the newspaper clipping and he held it up to my face and he was like, because you said something, they weren't investigated. Because the newspaper article said that Child Protective Services had been called, but there wasn't enough resources to go and check in on them. So he was like, because of you, these children are dead. And then he put the newspaper clipping on the refrigerator for about a year. So I got to see the faces of the children that I had. Yeah. The recruiters would come to our schools, right? And the Marines always looked so good. Like, they looked so sharp, whereas, like, the Army was always fat and, like, schlubby, I guess is, like, the best way to put it. But the Marines were always, like, crisp and sharp looking. And the recruiter that came to the school was also very hot. Like, I have to say, he was a very attractive man. And I was like, this is, I mean, if the Marines look like this, like, why would I not want to be around this? I did my due diligence, right? I went to the other branches and I was like, you know, what have you got? And the Army was like, we'll give you a $50,000 signing bonus or something. That was back when, like, friendly fire was constantly happening. It was always in the news about the Army killing each other. And I was like, I don't really want to be around a bunch of people that kill each other. So no, thank you. And then the Navy was never at work. So the recruiter was never there. So, yeah, I went with the Marines and I did, like, the ASVAB. He wanted me to go in as a member of the band. And, like, later on you find out, right, they get extra, or, like, it's a good thing if you get a member of the band. Like, that's, like, a, I don't know, one-up. So if you get, like, a female musician, like, come on. And then I was like, no, like, I enjoy playing the flute as, like, a hobby. I don't want to make that a job. That's not, I don't want to ruin my hobby. So I said no. And so when we did the ASVAB, I was just getting bored through it. I'm like, this is stupid. I'm tired of taking this test. And so after like 15 minutes, I'm like, I'm done. And I just started clicking. I was like, I'm done thinking. I walked out and he's like, you're done already? And I'm like, yeah. And he's like, what's your score? And I was like, 92. I was like, but I got really bored. So like, I probably could have done like a lot better. And he's like, okay. And he's like, when can you like leave? Took all AP classes. I was always like, I was set up to be a valedictorian of my class until I hit calculus. I got a B on a test. And so my grade slipped from like a 98 to like an 89. And I was like, I can't get my first B. I can't get a B. I'm just not going to continue this class anymore because if it's not perfect, I'm not going to be a part of it. So I didn't show up to the next four classes and immediately fail you at that point. So based on attendance. So I had like straight A's and an F from attendance. Had enough credits. I didn't have to go to school my last semester of high school. So I was like, as soon as possible, he's like, all right, you can be open contract. And I'm like, whatever, get me away from this. Because like the therapist that I had been seeing at that point for a year after I tried to kill myself, he was like, you need to leave your home immediately. Like, get out, like, now. I had a man that I was dating at the time. He died also. That was super fun to go through in therapy when you're 17. My therapist was like, you should leave. Like, you got to get out of this place. And I'm like, yeah, that's probably a good idea. I went open contract and I lied to my recruiter about any sort of mental, like, you know, if anything was wrong or whatever. And I was like, no, I'm fine. Well, because I felt like it was okay because the diagnoses of like bipolar were like proven to not be true. So I was like, no, I don't have any like diagnosis of anything because, you know, just a shitty childhood. And he's like, you'll fit right in. He didn't say that, but I did not pick my job. I went open contract, but then the night before shipping off at the hotel, like one of the gunnies, I don't know, I'm assumed he worked at the recruiting station because my recruiter was no longer around. He had gotten in trouble for getting one of my friends who was 16 pregnant and he was married. So my recruiter was not there at the hotel. It was this random gunnery sergeant and he pulls me aside and he's like, here's your new contract, sign it. And I'm like, what is this? And it says BX data systems. And I'm like, what is this? He's like, it's computers. And I'm like, I don't know anything about computers. And he's like, you'll be fine. You're smart. And so I just sign, but I see that it's changing my contract, my open contract of 4 years to 5 years. And I'm like, why is it going to five? And he's like, the school's long. So they need to make sure that they get, you know, their time out of you. Was slated to be 0656 is the tactical data networking specialist is and they've done away with all of these since then. It's still considered comms, but yeah, network engineering and administration. Boot camp was strange. I mean, getting yelled at and all that stuff it wasn't that bad. There was a comic strip that's out there where it's showing some kids at boot camp, and like they've had all their shit tossed everywhere, and like one of the recruits is like, oh my god, like what's going on, and one of the other guys is like, no, it's just like home. It's just like one like tear that comes out of his head, and I'm like, oh my god. So boot camp was fine with that. I was 17 and I was placed as the guide. We had 5 drill instructors and we ended with like, I think 33 girls in our platoon. Like there were not that many. I didn't graduate as the guide because I unked on the range. And the reason that I unked on the range, we were doing one of those hikes around the range. There was a hole and I stepped in it and I broke my ankle really badly. And I knew without a doubt, I did not want to be on that island a second longer than I had to be. So I sucked it up and I was like, I'm fine. But the drill instructors knew something was wrong. And so we were sitting there in like the kneeling position, right? And so I'm sitting there and the broken ankle is underneath like my butt. And I'm just like not in a good place. Like I'm tightening my boot as tight as it'll go. So it'll like have some sort of support. And I'm not kneeling down. And the drill instructor looks at me and she's like, you know, you see them like scanning and they see that something's wrong. And so she comes over and she takes my shoulders and she slams it down onto my ankle. She's like, it's fucking kneeling. And so I'm like, so like for the kneeling thing, I'm like, just like crying when pain. And yeah, so I unked the range. They fired me from being guide. And I was like destroyed by that. I made like I don't remember. I didn't unk. I wasn't even marksman. I was like, I think I was either sharpshooter or expert. But when you unk on the range the first time graduating boot camp, they say you're marksman. And I was like, well, that's embarrassing. Why would I go to medical? I didn't want to be there a second longer. Like, I didn't want to be considered weak or, you know, broken or anything. And the people in like the broken platoon, the broke dick platoon, like they looked miserable also. And I'm like, the fastest way to get off Paris Island is to just do it. The crucible was really, really rough. Like, I don't know. I just sucked it up. I don't advise that either. Like, I have severe ankle problems now on both of them because, like, by the time I got to comm school and I was put in charge of, like, I was the class commander there too. I had turned 18 at that point, but I was a class commander in charge of some Moroccan officers and then like 30 dudes. That was interesting, being the youngest and being the woman. I broke my ankle again running Sugar Cookie Mountain in 29 Palms. Well, I graduated top of my class in comm school, so I got meritorious Lance Corporal. Let's see, I checked into CLR 17 in Camp Pendleton, California. I got my preferred duty station because I was top of the class, so I got what I wanted. And it was crazy seeing Pendleton because the hills were so green and it was so beautiful and it was like nothing I had seen back home in, you know, Georgia, and I loved it. The best way to describe my Marine Corps experience is just a shit show. Like no one ever knew what was going on and everything was always chaotic. And we were fighting, you know, Iraq and Afghanistan. So the units were in their, the leave behind platoon, like the RBE, the remain behind element or whatever. I checked into an RBE and it was me and one sergeant and one corporal. And they just sat there and I had to unload a quad con by myself and load it back up and unload a quad con, like for weeks of just like doing this unloading, and they'd look at it and be like, no, you're fucked up. And then like, but these boxes are like comm equipment, right? And they're like 50 to 80 pounds each. And so I'd have to unload all of them on my own and then load them back up. And like, it was awful. But then people started filtering back in from the deployments, right? Like people started coming back from Iraq and stuff. And like people would waive their deployment, like their time back in America to go on the next deployment. So some people would be back for like 2 weeks and then leave again. So like it was very chaotic and like our TO was never filled. But there was, like, I remember everyone came back from Iraq and some guy drank a bottle of tequila and vomited so hard that he broke his ribs. And so that was like one of the stories. Those are my NCOs, right? Like that's who I had to like look up to, a bunch of like miserable people. They were smart though. I learned a lot from them. And then I was sent off to CLB 11 to go support the Mew. And that was my first week at CLB. We were signed up to go help another unit do some training. And so they wanted us to be the Hajis, right? They get like 13 of us up and we're allowed to wear civilian clothes. I'm like, fuck yes, right? Like I got jeans on. I got like my St. Louis, like the one shirt that I had from my childhood, like a white shirt. I'm going to get in the back of these up armored 7-tons, right? To go off in some other area of Pendleton. My unit experience was weird because I wasn't part of the in crowd. Like I was brand new to the unit. So I was kind of like, no one cares about her. She hasn't deployed yet. And it was just me. And then like the group of the people that had deployed together. And so they all get into this other 7-ton and they're all like having a good time laughing and joking. And I'm like, I felt weird. I didn't want to get into that 7-ton. And I didn't know if it was because of the people that were going into it or what. But I looked at it and I was like, something feels weird about that. So I go and I get into the other 7-ton. We had to wear our flak and Kevlar, right? And this is my first like in the fleet field event kind of thing. And I'm like, I don't want to fucking wear my Kevlar, right? Like, so I have a bun from, you know, I had to have my hair in a bun and like wearing the Kevlar, it hurt because like it wouldn't go on right. It wouldn't buckle like with my hair. And I was like, I don't want to do this. So my Kevlar was in my lap and my flak was open. And I was just like, you know, not taking it seriously. No one was. Like the people in the vehicle also, like their flak was on the ground or like they didn't even have like their Kevlars or whatever. The packing list did say to bring like your first aid kit, your IFAC. I was the only one that had like a first aid kit. And so we're going off to do this thing through like these windy streets and like we're going pretty fast. Up Armor 7-ton has like this tiny little window, right? Like because the benches are facing out and you can see like this tiny little window down like by your feet. Canvas top, you know, heavy steel sides and stuff. We're going like really fast and like we're like swaying around like a lot. And then there's like squealing and there's slamming. And like all of a sudden we go up one side and then we slam back down. And I look out the window because everyone's like, what the fuck? And I look out the window and I can see the first 7-ton. And people all over the ground. 7-ton had flipped and everyone was like tossed out of it. And like, I'm like, they fucking flipped, get out, get out. And so we start climbing out. I look around and I'm seeing the people that had gone to war, the people who were supposed to be, you know, knowing what to do, shell-shocked of like frozen, did not know what to do. And I'm like, go call like 911 right now. And like, cause we're on base, right? There's no service. And so like, people are like, what do we do? And I'm like, go fucking run and go get service. Like there's people just scattered. And so I'm like, start getting them. And like, here I am 18, brand new to the unit, the lowest rank. And I'm watching these NCOs just stumble in like a time of like need. It was so infuriating. Like, it was frustrating. Like these were supposed to be the people that were leading. Why are they not doing it? So we start gathering people up and like kind of triaging them as we can. The majority were okay, right? Like granted, they might have suffered concussions and stuff like that, but the majority were okay. People just start deferring to me. And I'm like, this is weird because, you know, I'm 18. I don't know what the fuck I'm doing. I don't know any of these people's names. I don't know anything. People are sending these people over to me while I'm like doing like triage on these people because I'm the only one that packed a first aid kit. But there's a woman that comes over from the first van or the first 7-ton, and she had also not worn her Kevlar. And when the 7-ton flipped, her face smashed in and her nose was ripped off and you could see her brain. She was like, am I okay? And I'm like, you're good. You're fine. You're fine. Just sit down. And like the girl who had brought her over to me was like, not okay. And went and vomited in the bushes. And then I'm like, hey, can you come sit with her? Cause there's, and someone's like, Cannon, come over here. And I'm like, just sit with her. Just tell her she's okay. And she's like, but, and I'm like, shh, she's fine. Tell her she's fine. And so she's sitting there like you could just, it was awful. Her nose was like to the side, like open to the side. And this was sliced open and cracked and you could see her brain. At some point, the first sergeant's sprinting to us and I see his face of just like, I don't want to say, like kind of like terror. I know he's sitting there looking at like what is happening and he's like, what the fuck? I hear my name getting called and they're like, Cannon. I'm like going over there. So the 7-ton had flipped onto its side and had drug right along the road. So like there were rivets of like where the screws had scraped into the road in the pavement. And so we had gotten like everyone out except for one person. One person was still in the back of the 7-ton. They're like, we need you in here. And I'm like, all right. what's going on. And like, you go in and like, you know, it's a sunny San Diego day. So when you step into like the 7-ton, cause I'm on the side of it and like ducking down, pitch black dark. Right. And I'm like, what's happening back here? And like, you know, it's chaotic and no one knows what to do. And I'm like, why are we not? I'm like standing on the steel part and there's a guy that's laying there. And I'm like, why are we not getting him out? And then I look and I see that his arm is underneath the 7-ton. And he had put his hand out to brace. And when it fell, it had gone underneath and had been dragged. And I realized I was standing on his arm. Like, it was underneath the steel and like I was standing on it. And I'm like, and you can't really see anything, right? Like, again, it's very dark. And I'm like, fuck. And I'm like, someone get a knife. And someone luckily has a pocket knife. And so they come and I just take and I like cut the canvas of the 7-ton, right? So we could at least see something. And then I'm like, all right. So the canvas is like slid open. We can see now. I'm like, all right. I'm like, what's your name? And he's still lucid, right? Still like awake. He's like, oh, I don't remember his name. I'm like, all right, well, hey, look, like this might hurt a little bit, but you know, just tell me like, you know, what do you like to do? Do you have any like pets at home or anything like that? And I take his arm and I start breaking it to get it to come out from underneath this, like, cause you're not going to be able to like get it lifted anytime soon. So there's like the steel of the 7-ton side. And then like, there's a weird bar above it. And so his arm was in between like the bar and like the steel plate. And so I'm just like hearing everything tear and crack. And I'm like, just getting it out. And then I get it out and we're able to like flip him over. And I'm like, someone go get a stick. And again, it's surreal because I'm like ordering these people around that are like above me in rank. I don't know them. Like, I'm like, go get a fucking stick. And I take strips of the canvas and I like kind of splint his arm this way and then this way. And I like wrap the canvas from the top of the 7-ton and like the stick and whatever, go back to work. And I'm covered head to toe in blood. Nothing ever happened from that. Like, I get the chain of command was relieved. I found a newspaper article on it. Cause, like, years later, I'm like, why didn't they like, this to me was a huge deal. There's one tiny newspaper article on it that says like 7-ton flipped on for a training event on Camp Pendleton. And it's like, you know, some people were medically evacuated. That's it. Like, went to like the nearest hospital. But a couple of months later, it was probably like 6 months later, someone was like, Cannon, come over here. And like, they pull me over and it was the guy with the arm and like his arm's in a sling. And they're like, dude, this is the girl who saved your arm. And he's like, and I'm like, oh my God, I'm so glad that your arm's okay. Like, or at least, you know, and he was like, they said that, you know, if you hadn't have done that, I would have had to lose my arm. And so like, luckily it was in the splint and he was like, look what I can do. And he's like wiggling his fingers. And I'm like, that's awesome. But yeah, I have no idea about the girl. I got some good training out of it. I learned pretty much not to trust my leadership after that though. Like, it was just disappointing because, you know, they talk about when things happen, like, are you someone that jumps into action? Are you someone that's like frozen, right? Like, we have different like fight or flight or freeze and stuff. And I just saw that all of them that had been to war didn't know what to do and froze. And I was like, oh, fuck. I was with CLB-11 when all of that happened with the 7-ton, was dating my corporal at the time. And it was, he was the one who had welcomed me to the unit to begin with. I found out later that there was like a who can fuck her first kind of bet going on in the shop. You know, met him and started dating him. The company gunny found out, was furious, and was like, I don't want to deal with women on deployment. So he sent me back to CLR 17. I married him. So not the company gunny. I married him, the guy I've been dating. And then they created like the first MLG forward unit. Like, they stood it up. And that was interesting because I didn't realize what I was getting myself into in the Marine Corps. I'm going to sound really stupid when I say that I didn't know that I would be shooting guns in boot camp kind of stuff. I knew the Marines were, you know, badass. And like, I saw like in 2012, the fall of Fallujah. I remember like, I was like 12 and like sitting in front of the TV watching like all these really cool things. And I'm like, oh my God, that's so cool. But it never translated that I would actually be part of that. I'm like, you know, they're not going to teach me how to do any of that. In the Marine Corps, they never were clear about what was going to happen, right? Like, you know, you're going to go to war. Like, there was never a question that you were going to go. It was of when, in that time frame, at least. Like, everyone who joined, you were going to go to war. It's just when, and if you hadn't been, you were a piece of shit. You know, I knew it was going to happen, but, like, I didn't know what that entailed. I didn't know, like, what workups were, right? Like, I didn't know that there were certain things that you had to do in order to get your unit ready to deploy. Like, I was just showing up to work, man. So did a bunch of exercises constantly in class. Like, my job was obviously very technical. I had to learn a bunch of stuff. I was either in the field or in a class. Always. The op tempo was insane. And even sometimes when I was in class, I was also in the field. So it was like a weird doubled up. And I was also taking classes, night classes for college. And so that was an interesting trying to balance like all of that plus this op tempo. But no one ever tells you like what you're going to be doing, right? So I was just showing up to work, doing what I was doing, and then like leaving. We were going and doing like the shot X's and doing like, you know, getting all these tests done and making sure we're all ready. You know, I guess Lance Corporals don't have to know much, right? But I would like to be informed about what's happening. So I remember everyone getting lined up inside of this warehouse. And it's everyone in the whole unit, right? Getting ready to go. And so there's this table in the front and like everyone's there. They're doing the shots, they're doing whatever. And then they get all the women to come forward and they all give us cups. And they all go tell us to pee and bring our cups back. And so we go off to the bathrooms and there's, I don't know. Comm has a lot of women in it, right? Like, because radio has a lot. Data doesn't have that many. But we all went off, filled up our cups of pee, and then had to parade our pee in front of everyone in our company up to the front of the table. And then they test it for pregnancy in front of everyone, which is also weird and not like, can you imagine finding out that you're pregnant in front of everyone in your company? So everyone was clear and we, you know, were ready to go off to war. And so we all deploy off to Leatherneck. So we go to check in with the battalion's CO, and he's looking at all of us and he's like, "You're women." I'm like, "Yes, sir, we are." He did not want us there at all. He was used to a unit of all men, did not want women there, and made it very clear that we would be leaving because he did not want to deal with us. And those were paraphrasing his words. So instead of us going out to the Georgian liaison team, we stayed back with RCT2, stayed on their compound on Delarom. When they found out that they actually couldn't send us back, we ended up just sticking with RCT2 for the rest of the deployment. Sandwith and I were the only women on that base for months. Months and months. Eventually, as Delarom got built up, because it was going to eventually become the airfield, and there were constant explosions going on because they were trying to break down the rock in order to make the airfield, women started coming eventually, like near the end. But in the beginning times, it was just me and her, and we never saw each other because she was with the satellite people and I was with all the data people. So it was a very, very lonely time in Afghanistan. Lots of ostracization, lots of men that were trying to have sex with me and who got mad when I wouldn't, or, you know, it was really rough. I'm not sure how much to say without like ruining the book entirely, because I do want people to read it. I don't want to like summarize it in a couple of minutes because the nuances in it are pretty intense. My experience in Afghanistan culminated with me being pregnant in a combat zone and still providing communications to the grunts that were out there. And I don't know, I loved working with the grunts. I wasn't part of the female engagement team, but I would go and get pulled off of Delarom's compound to go do satellite and other communications repairing for the grunts. I found out later that they were purposely breaking their communications equipment, so I would come out and fix it. But I enjoyed going out and hanging out with them because they had like this, they had taken the town of Delarom, and there was the Afghanistan National Army's general's house, and they were sharing it with the ANA, like, general. And so, like, it was split into, like, two. And there was, like, I want to say, like, 15 grunts in this compound thing. And they treated me like a sister. I enjoyed my time with them. I remember we went out, and it was me and my friend Verkler. You know, two corporals going out to fix communications, and we were out there and everything's fixed. And it took us like maybe 20 minutes to fix their problem. But they had to come out, like take the convoy out to get us and then drive us in. And we were there and they didn't want to run us back. So they're like, "You'll stay here for a few days." So we just hung out on the compound, and like, I felt worthless, not like helping them out because these guys were covered in dirt. And there was one like makeshift like shower thing with like a plastic water holder, and you could go and like take a shower, but that was like it. And they weren't taking showers that much. Everyone was dirty and tired. And I mean, they were constantly having to react to what was going on in the town and constantly go on patrols. They would do a morning patrol and a night patrol and stuff. And, you know, they looked so tired. And so they were getting ready for like their nighttime patrol. And I was like, why don't we do it? And, you know, like me and Verkler, like we're very well rested. We have very nice, clean camis. Like, why aren't we going to go out? Like, the platoon sergeant for the grunts was, he was such a badass. Like, I don't know. Like, I looked up to him so much because everyone respected what he said when, you know, he said jump, they immediately did it, and they did it higher than he wanted, you know, like knew his shit. He was in Fallujah also. And so it was kind of cool knowing that what I was watching on the TV when I was 12 was something he was partaking in. And then I get to go and like be around this badass war hero. I just felt comforted when I was around him because I knew that like if something was going to go down, it was going to be okay. But he, you know, looked at us and he's like, all right, fine, let's go. Y'all, you two Marines go sleep and we'll take these like huyas out for a stroll around the town. And so we would go out and like do these patrols. And like one of the grunts was like, oh, you're calm. Like, take the fucking radio. So I went to go get the radio and I'm like, oh, fuck, this thing weighs a lot. A full combat load, like my flak and Kevlar and like my IFAC and my dump pouch, like all this kind of stuff. And I'm like, all right, sure, I'll add. Like, obviously, I'm not going to show that I'm like, I don't know about this because I think I weighed like 115 and I was not like, being back in the fleet, we didn't PT like at all because we were either in the field or, and we were in the field doing comm stuff, not in the field like grunts are where they're like, you know, going for hikes and doing like maneuvering and stuff like that. We weren't doing that. We were going and like setting up servers and getting satellite communications up and making sure the internet was going to get to the COC and stuff like that. I go off to Afghanistan and like, there was nowhere you could really run. I was unsure of being able to carry this like giant load. And like Verkler is looking at me and he's like, you good? And I'm like, I'm fine. I'm good. I'm not going to show these grunts that I can't do this. So like I put on the, my backpack and we're going off and like something happens and we have to start running. And I'm like, ooh, I'm in like the hurt locker. Like essentially like my body is not handling this well. Like I was not trained for this part. We're running and like, you know, the flak jacket is not fit for me. None of the equipment worked on me because I was just too short and little and it was built for giant men with muscles. And that was not what I was. And I was going through and I remember like having to squat and like the platoon sergeant like runs over to me and he's like, give me the radio. I'm like, no, I'm good. He's like, Cannon, give me the fucking radio. And he takes it from me and he goes and he gives it to Berkler because I was just like hurting pretty rough. And like I go back that night and like my hips are bloody. I have to like peel my shorts off of like the blood that's just broken up because I was in a bad place. The memories that I really enjoyed from Afghanistan were ones when on night shift, I would walk outside and see the entire sky full of the most clear, beautiful stars ever. And right around like 3:30 in the morning, the sky would start lighting up in like pinks and lighter blues. And eventually the sun would just be blazing at like 5 a.m. But the stillness and the calmness and the beauty of the desert skies at night is amazing. Made me feel very small and in a good way. There was a time with the grunts that we were having like a cookout. The guys were all making food and we were just relaxing, I think, probably for the first time, like joking around. And some of the kids from inside the town were like launching rocks over the wall and trying to hit us with them and stuff. And, you know, just being little shithead kids and we're like throwing rocks back at them and stuff. And it was the best meal ever. That like the translator had gone out and gotten some like really warm grapes that tasted so juicy. And I'm like, where on earth in this town of nothingness are grapes coming from? On one of the patrols, there was a little gate that was open and a doorway that I could see into. And there were these three little heads that like popped out, and there were three women in the most beautiful, bright colors I had ever seen. Like, and you know, you look at like the, just the desert, you think about Afghanistan, it's like desert and dusty and like all this stuff. And it's like, that's true. And then this inside this mud hut is like this beautiful set of women, and they were like girls though. They were probably like 10 or 11 and like maybe 19. And they run out when they see that I'm a woman, and they run out to me and they start like touching my hair and my face, and they're like speaking to me, and they're just so excited to see me, and they're like gesturing to the men, and they're speaking in something that I don't know, and I'm like, what's happening? The translator like comes up and he's like, they never see women, and like it's interesting for them to be able to see a woman like that. And I'm like, this is surreal. They were so excited to see me though, and like them just touching me was like, it's pretty cool. Yeah, I had a really good time with the grunts, but what was going on back on Delaram was that there was a contractor who I ended up having a consensual relationship with, and he got me pregnant, and then proceeded to abuse me for months after that. So awful that I put the bottom of, or the muzzle of my rifle into the bottom of my chin, and I tried to pull the trigger, and I couldn't reach the trigger, which is, in hindsight, almost laughable, just how much the equipment was not built for us. Because I didn't have, like, one of the M4s that had the collapsible buttstock where you can actually, like, reach in. It was, like, the old-school M16 with the long-ass, like, thing. So if I was going to shoot it with a flak on, I couldn't reach the trigger either. The abuse that I endured with him was way more emotional, psychological abuse. There was some physical intimidation and threats. There was one time in a bunker, he punched the wall beside my head and picked me up and threw me up against the bunker. There's that. It got to the point also where he was raping me, and I couldn't do anything about it because I was pregnant and he was going to turn me in if I did say something. I mean, I was 20 years old, pregnant in a war zone with a unit that I didn't know. I like, Verkler was the closest thing I had to a friend. And even he was like, you know, women and the Marine Corps, he wasn't used to working with them because they didn't have them at RCT. And they certainly didn't deploy. I had to win him over as a friend. And then I didn't have anyone to really talk to. We were in River City all the time, so communication was cut off. What occurred between the contractor and myself was difficult for me to process as a 20-year-old with no one to really talk to. The rapes that occurred were based off of when I would say, no, I don't want to, he would hold me down and force me. Every conversation that surrounded my interactions with him, he made it very clear that the fact that I was pregnant meant that he could take everything from me, and he would threaten to go to the command to get me taken away. And then he threatened to get me arrested. And he said, when you're in the brig, I will take your child and I will raise her instead. And it was crazy because I knew he would do that. He had actually told me back when we were on decent terms, before I knew I was pregnant, he had told me about one of his past relationships and how he had already had a daughter and he took her from her mom. He had framed it then as, oh, she was crazy. And like, now I know you cannot trust a man that says, you know, oh, my ex is crazy, because I don't know what has been done to her to make her act a certain way. So he took his first child away from the mother and wanted me to raise it, and was like, oh, you'll be a great mother. This was all at first, right? When everything's good. Oh, you'll be a great mother. Like, he didn't want me to have education. The fact I was going to school, he was like, oh, don't do that. Like, he used religion similarly to my family of upbringing, that religion was the way it should be, that the woman would stay at home and be a homemaker. And I'm like, well, I like, you know, cooking and taking care of things. Like, I like that. Like, that sounds like good. But then over time, it morphed into, you will do what I say. And if you don't, I will take everything from you. And it's difficult because it's not always that open and blatant and blunt. It's not always like, if you do this, I will do this. It's so much more subtle than that. Wouldn't let me talk to other men. The fact that I was friends with Verkler was a problem. He monitored my email that would come in and out because he was also working in IT. And I don't know how he, like, your systems administrators can read your email. They, you know, everyone has, like, you're supposed to be ethical in how you deal with it, but he was not. He was reading the emails that I was sending to people trying to get help and trying to figure out what to do. And I was so scared. Like, I knew he would not just take everything from me, but like, if I'm 20 years old and I don't have anything to go back to, I don't have a home to go back to, I can't, like, what am I going to raise a child in my family's house? Like, I wouldn't have been welcome back to begin with, but I didn't have a lot of options. And so part of me thought, like, well, I can make this work with this guy, right? Like, I mean, he does have a good job. He's got all of this stuff. Like, I can just figure it out, right? Like, I want to have this baby. I want to, like, do this. So I didn't have a lot of options. I did everything that I could to figure out, like, okay, if I get sent to the brig and this baby gets taken away from me, what can I do? Like, what's the recourse that I have? And it didn't look like there was a lot of options. And I know that you have to reach 3 years of honorable service in order to get discharged and to retain your benefits, right? Like, you, in order to get the GI Bill. And I was like, I had been using tuition assistance, like, struggling, knowing that, like, going to college was the only way I was going to not end up how my mom ended up, unable to get out of an abusive situation. I was like, well, I'll reach my 3 year mark on this date. If I can just get to this date. I mean, besides the personal shit that was going on with me, like, we were in a war zone, right? Like, we had, I still had to go out and help the guys and saw some shit and got shot at. But that, like, doesn't even resonate in, like, my storytelling of Afghanistan. I'm like, yeah, it was, like, whatever. Like, it barely registered. Like, that doesn't matter. It was, like, someone that was trying to snipe me. And they probably just had some sort of weapon that, you know, wasn't remotely ranged in. Anyway, the amount of crazy shit that happens in a war zone, like, it's just another day of, like, oh, yeah, that happened. It didn't. I don't remember having nightmares about that, if that makes sense. But yeah, I mean, we were sitting there. It was one of the night patrols and something was going down in the town. It was dark and I wasn't allowed to go on the patrol because I didn't have NVGs because I was just some pogue from a unit that somewhere else. And I was in the middle of this fucking desert, not where I was supposed to be. And I was repeatedly told you were not supposed to be here. And so they left me as, like, me and one other guy, like, the entrance of the tiny compound. Like, so there were walls set up and the entrance where the MATVs would, like, pull in. I was, like, on this side of the wall. The opening is right here. And so I'm standing right here looking down the street this way. And the other guy is standing this way and looking down the street that way, right? And so we're just, like, looking. He's got NVGs. I don't. Pitch black, dark. No one's around. Grunts and Verkler are off doing their patrol thing. And I'm like, man, I am dehydrated. Like, I haven't done anything all day. I can't see shit. I'm, like, trying to remember, like, what they taught us at MCT, like, the whole being able to see in the dark, like, covering up an eye. And, like, you know, I'm like, I don't remember this either. And I'm like, okay, man, if I get a flashlight in the eye, I'm going to be blinded. I, like, was standing up, right? And my Kevlar was on. And the mud wall was, like, right here on me. And, like, just the very tip of my head was over. And, like, because I was doing the crouching down thing and, like, I stood up to, like, stretch or something. And then we hear someone running down the road coming towards us. And it's, you know, the platoon sergeant. And I'm like, I can tell that his run from a mile away, right? And he's coming up and he's talking to me. Well, we're taking care of what's going on over there. Like, how are y'all doing here? And then he, like, looks up at the building across the street and then tackles me down. And someone shoots. and had barely missed me. The guy that was watching us with NVGs, he was aiming directly at your head. And I'm like, oh, just, you know, continue the day. Like, what are you going to do? Like, the platoon sergeant ran off, you know, try to go chase this guy. And he like disappeared and he couldn't catch him. Like, he was probably doing roof jumping or whatever. But there was one night I was back on Delarom doing some middle of the night stuff. I was put on night shift. The CO didn't want me around when most of the people were around. I was adding a switch to one of the tents so they could have extra computers. Every network device needs to have an IP address, right, in order to get it to function, right? Like, that's what networking is. Everything needs to be able to communicate. And how do you do that? You have an IP address. Well, we were tracking our IP addresses on some spreadsheet on SharePoint. And I went to go look at the address and I pick like the next IP address. And I'm like, all right. And I go to like install this switch in like the middle of the night. And this is where like my memory, I don't trust it anymore because, you know, I wrote what I wrote in the book and I had feedback from some of the guys that were there. They told me like, you know, that's not how it went. Like, you know, I remember this. I have nightmares about it all the time. And I'm like, look, I had nightmares for 7 years about this before I started talking to people, before I got in touch with the guys again, right? Like, I had these nightmares, and so I didn't know what was real and what was not. The reality for me for 7 years and what my brain played every night was that I installed a switch with the wrong IP address, and I took down the COC. I know that happened. That is a fact. So the whole COC went down, and that was the same time that the grunts were on a patrol trying to clear IEDs. One of the guys died. And I fucked up communications to where he couldn't get medevaced. And so for years, I had these nightmares of the screams on the radio. What I know is true also is they came back after their convoy and all the guys were in shell shock. They left their MATVs. They had four. They left them and I saw them all coming out and I was, you know, making sure the people that I cared about were there and alive because I didn't know who it was when I realized who it was. And yeah, Joshua Dumas. He left behind a wife and child. She gave birth after he died. All the guys went off to the chaplain, and me and the gunny stayed back. And like, I'm looking at like the truck and I'm seeing, you know, everything that Dumas had stepped on an ID and blown up in front of this one vehicle. And it had cami netting all over it. There was blood everywhere. And, like, my nightmares have blood pouring out of the back of the MATV, but I don't know if that's real. And the gunny told me to leave. And he's like, you shouldn't be seeing this. And he's crying. That's real. And I go and run, and I'm like, they can't come back to this. And I go and I run up to the COC, and I grab some trash bags and some bottles of water and a broom and go back and climb on the mat V, and the gunny's just sitting there crying. He's like, you shouldn't fucking be here. We shouldn't be here. And we're picking up bits of his body out of the cami netting, and it's just like shards of bone and torn bits of camis. And I'm trying to pour water onto the blood and scrub it out. And, like, you're sitting there and you're holding what's left of someone's body. Like, what do you do with it? Put it in a trash bag and throw it away. Like, I... Everything past his death was... It felt like the world was just dark for years after that. And I blamed myself. I was pregnant and being abused and being raped, and I didn't really have a place to go. I put a gun to my chin and tried to kill myself and didn't succeed because I couldn't reach the trigger. At some point, it gets so bad that someone told on me. And working night shift in communications, like you have to talk to other bases, right? You have to go call the other line, the other end, and talk to them on the phone to be like, hey, I'm about to do this. I'm about to make this change, right? Like that's part of some troubleshooting. And there was someone on Camp Leatherneck. His name was Ed. He was a contractor. We had gotten to know each other over, you know, the months of doing like night shift and stuff. And he, like one night when we were doing some sort of maintenance, he was like, Cannon, what is going on? You do not sound okay. And I'm like, you know, just some shit, right? Like some stuff's going on. Like, and he's like, look, you're about to be back in America. Like, it'll be okay. He was trying really hard to like help me, right? And I was like, I don't know, man. I don't see the point anymore. And he's like, what do you mean? And I'm like, what's the fucking point? Like, people are just over here living in misery and dying. And like, what is the point? And he was like, you know, you need to go talk to someone. And I'm like, who is there to talk to? I don't trust anyone. And I like hang up the phone and he calls back and I unplug the phone because I don't want to hear him, right? I don't want to hear it. And so the very next day, he walks into the first MEF, like, battle rhythm meeting, and he stands up and he's like, we have a corporal on Del Ram that's suicidal, and she is not being taken care of. And they yanked me out of Del Ram so fast. Immediately, I got my rifle taken away. I got sent to medical, and I'm sitting there, and I'm actually actively bleeding and having what I think is a miscarriage. And I'm trying to get help for it with the doc and the most apathetic piece of shit corpsman I have ever met. And he's just like, what's wrong? Yeah, you're sad. Okay, cool. Like, isn't everyone just like, you know, just, and I'm just like, not okay, right? Like, I am in the middle of miscarrying and I'm thinking like, you know, what's going to happen to me? Like, I need to tell these people like the truth and like what's happening. And I'm like, I was raped and I think I'm losing the baby. And he walks outside of the room and announces to everyone, including the CO, including all these people. She says she was raped. She's pregnant and losing the baby. You know, that shit spread like wildfire. I lost my ability to do a restricted report that would have protected my privacy of any sort. You know, I had said this to a medical professional to get help. And what transpired from then on was really poorly done. I was medevaced though. Going on a medevac with a bunch of people with missing limbs and going and being part of Wounded Warrior Battalion where like giant airplane that they put us all in, people that could walk, you know, ignored for the people who couldn't, which makes sense, right? Like they don't give a fuck about you if you are mobile, and being put on this flight with people screaming because they have missing limbs and they're right in front of you. And it's so fucking cold on those flights. And again, like no one's really telling you what's going on, right? Like, I don't know where I was in Afghanistan. I don't remember like the different helicopters I got put on. I didn't know if I was in the right spot ever. And being medevaced in Wounded Warrior Battalion, like they give you all this money to like buy clothes. And I felt so gross because I was like, you know, I'm here because I fucked up. Like, I don't need to be treated like this. Like the people at the mall in Germany, they were like, you sacrificed so much, you're a hero. And I'm like, ugh, fuck you. I'm like, no, I'm not. I was sent to Wounded Warrior Battalion in Germany. So Landstuhl was where I was medically evacuated to see if, you know, if I was okay to go back to America. My unit was leaving anyway. My unit actually beat me back to America. So their tour was done. So like the timing was just, I ended up landing in America after they did. And so I wasn't like assigned to Wounded Warrior Battalion. It's just that's who processes the people out of Afghanistan and then to Landstuhl. And then like I was given a commercial plane ticket to come home because they're like, you need to pretty much be bedridden for the next like couple of months because you can't have any high stress situations or anything like that. So I was given like a commercial plane ticket and like all I had on my person was my ID, right? Like I didn't have a phone. I didn't have anything. And I'm like, you know, leaving Germany, don't speak a lick of German. And I'm like, I don't know what's going on here. And I go back to America and no one's there to get me from the airport, and no one's like, my unit does their own thing. Like, I didn't have that, like, welcome back from, you know, deployment kind of return, and cried for the next year, essentially. I did not want to have a child with someone who was going to control me in the way that the contractor was going to control me. And so I got an abortion. And that decision has been something that I have regretted every day. I also so grateful that I had the option to, because I can't imagine being in a situation similar to my mom. And I spent the next 2 years being the network operations chief on Camp Pendleton. And it was great because the job was so fucking 24/7. Like, it was a 24/7 ops, like, you know, for garrison and networking. There are two mini networks that the military runs, right? You have Nipper, which is what everyone uses for like Google and all that. And then you have Sipper, where all the secret stuff is. And then you have other classifications. And that's about as detailed as I'm going to get. Everyone knows that kind of stuff though, right? Like, there's stuff you can't access. Well, being the network operations chief, I was in charge of the networks for everything west of the Mississippi. We had communications all through like Fort Huachuca and Pendleton, any Marine Corps base, like west of the Mississippi. The secret networks run over something called encryptors, right? Like, you have this encrypting device that makes it super secret where people can't get to it. Something was going wrong with one of the encryptors that had all of the routes for every single network west of the Mississippi that was providing services for every base that was doing like secret operations kind of stuff. And something was going wrong with it. And me and my boss at the time are like looking at it. And he's like, what do we do? Like, we can't seem to like fix this like one issue. And I'm like, I don't even know. I'm like, you know, always turning it off and turning it back on again is normally like what happens, right? Turn it off and turn it back on again. So like services go down to get it to work. It didn't fix the issue. And so I was like, oh, fuck. And so there's something called zero eyes, which means you pretty much blank out the whole entire attack lane. And it's a big button, right, that you're not supposed to press. And my boss is like, I mean, I don't know what else to do at this point. Like, just restart it from scratch and like zero eyes it and like get the keys back on it. And I'm like, okay. Like, so I go and like, I go to zeroize. My boss is telling me to do it, right? And so I go and like zeroize it. Anyway, no one had Sipper services for a very long time because I had wiped out every single possible communication. It was, luckily no one died that time. We were getting the network back from contractors that had had it for so many years. And I was a sergeant at this point. I had been promoted. And the people that we got from the schoolhouse, I think two other people had been to like war and like come back. And so everyone else, though, they didn't know what a networking equipment was. I'm like, what are they teaching at the schoolhouse? You can't do anything. Like, we're taking this network back from the contractors. And like, I got a bunch of Marines that don't know like a router from a hole in the wall. Like, they can't help me out at all. And it was just, I mean, 2 years of 24/7 operations. It was a lot of fun, though. I learned a lot about leadership at that point, like actually being a decent leader. And because I'll be honest, coming back from Afghanistan, I was a bitch. I was mad all the time. I ran the Marines into the dirt and like would laugh when they would puke. Like, I don't care. I was one of those. I had become one of the people that you like, you know, hate coming back from deployment. Like, some miserable sergeant that wants you to hate life. I cared a lot about my Marines, but I also really didn't like them because I thought that they were weak and that they didn't know much. At that point, I didn't really know that the job that I had was to make sure that they weren't weak and knew more. 2 years were at Marine Corps Base Camp Pendleton before I got out of the Marine Corps, and I was so excited to leave the Marine Corps. Leaving active duty was the easiest hard thing I had ever done. I was so ready to get out of the Marine Corps. I hated the bullshit. I hated the bureaucracy. I hated that it seemed like the most unintelligent people stayed in and got promoted in charge of me. And I hated being led by idiots. That's not everyone. I had a lot of good leaders too. It was weird. I felt like I had a lot of time on my hands. There was like 1 month where I didn't like have anything to do because I was following my new husband to Japan because he got orders to Japan. So I sat around and I went to like Zumba classes and I was like, I would work out like four times a day. I didn't know what to do with myself. Like, I had never really enjoyed not working since I was like 13. So like, it was my first time of like being able to relax. And I was like, I don't know what to do. I think one of the hardest things that in transitioning was learning how to have good, deep, supportive relationships with women, because the Marine Corps teaches you that the women that are next to you are your competition, be it for male attention or for being the biggest badass in the unit. Or I just didn't have any women around me. Like, I didn't really serve with a lot of women either. So I struggled to be able to have good interactions with women. And now I have friends that I've had for women friends for 10 years, 11 years, and they are like the most enriching relationships, but it took work to get to there because I was very crass. Like I said, I was very angry for years. I was depressed for years about what had happened. I had nightmares and I couldn't sleep and I really struggled to overcome what I had done. I had buried everything, right? I didn't talk about it. I didn't want to talk about it. And like, how could I have friendships with people if they don't know some of the worst things about me? I felt like I had to hide everything about who I was, and because I was ashamed of it. I was ashamed of everything that I had done and been a part of and had gone through. And I just ignored it. And I started getting sick all the time. There were gaps in my brain of what happened. There were gaps in time after the Marine Corps where I think I was so depressed I don't remember chunks of time. I, you know, was diagnosed with anxiety and depression, and I was trying to get in to see a therapist. And I was trying so many different things. And finally, I was like, I'm just going to start writing. So I started writing what had happened on a blog that my friends had access to. Acting like things hadn't happened only harmed me further. And this was the first time that people were able to actually see what I had been through and done and accomplished too, because, you know, I had done good things as well. The comments I got were like, oh my God, for one, we didn't know that you were going through this, that you had even done this. Like, you didn't talk about any of this. And they were like, you need to write a book about it. And I'm like, oh, I'm just getting it out, right? But like, I wrote it, saved my life writing the book. I would stay up all night putting on music and just sobbing while I'm like writing what had happened, actually addressing what had happened for a long time. It took me about 2 months to complete the book and took it off my blog. And everyone's like, no, this definitely needs like everything you had been through. Like, it needs to, people need to know that this is happening, that, you know, women are enduring this type of ostracization and abuse from people. Not just Marines, right? Like, this was a contractor and like the CO had failed at multiple levels. I don't want women to go through what I had gone through. I want more men to understand, to like keep an eye on the people that are around them, right? Like, hold each other accountable for how they talk to women and how they treat women that are around them. Because I didn't get the camaraderie of the people around me, because they were either trying to fuck me or we were worried about getting killed. So like, my closest friends were probably the grunts and Verkler. I want more people to understand the nuance of things. And I want people to know that if we only expect those without flaws to speak up, we're not ever going to change anything. Like, there's not a single person who hasn't fucked up. That doesn't mean that we deserve to be treated poorly. It felt like getting myself to a good place mentally was a full-time job for a decade. Felt like I tried everything. And there's not one quick fix for anything, right? Like, I think there are tools that can help make fixes better. I tried everything from being mindful of my body. Like, I did so much CrossFit all the time that I was putting my central nervous system into a constant state of heightened anxiety. So it was actually making my mental state not any better, like releasing that cortisol through my system. My sympathetic nervous system was constantly on fire. And so my anxiety was through the roof and I wasn't sleeping. And I was doing all this constant state of panic, I guess. So I did a lot of focusing on how to bolster my parasympathetic nervous system to calm myself down. So stuff like yoga. I became a yoga teacher and I started teaching people yoga, like actually understanding as you're moving, feeling the movements in your body, like not just reaching for something, reaching and actually feeling the motion go through your hands, feel when you touch something, what it feels like. There's something called active meditation. So imagine you're taking a shower, right? And you're going through and you're washing your hair. Like most people are like, yeah, I'm just washing my hair. But when you're going through and you're like feeling as the water is going through your hair, going and like as it drips down, feeling your fingers massage, you're like slowing down and actively meditating all your different motions. That helped a lot doing the yoga, doing a lot of breath work. There's Wim Hof who does a lot of the cold breathing techniques, a lot of the getting control of your breath. I did a lot of cold shock therapy, making myself get into freezing cold, you know, ice chunks everywhere to shock my body. And there's so many podcasts that go into the science of why all this helps. But, you know, our mental brain is supported by our physical body, and we do hold trauma in our body. There are books that I read, The Body Keeps the Score. I highly advise anyone that has gone through trauma to read that and understand how your body is reacting as being normal. I did so much individual work on the books that I read. Another one that I would always suggest to people is On Killing by Lieutenant Colonel Grossman, I think is how you pronounce it. Phenomenal book about, you know, the mental stuff that they do to make us effective killers and why we struggle so much when we come back from combat. We aren't meant to want to kill. And so when you have been to that place and you know what it means to want to kill and you try to reintegrate with society, like you don't feel like you fit in with them anymore. Like you interact with people on the street and they don't know that dark part of you like you know. And it's scary to know that that part of you exists. So understanding like why you feel that way was well explained in On Killing, and I enjoyed that, knowing that that dark part of me wasn't bad, and the fact that I felt guilt or shame or fear and just about knowing that that part existed in me was made me more of a human than anything, and knowing that I felt bad was a good thing, a sign of my humanity, and holding on to that as a way to get away from feeling guilty for aiming a gun at a child, you know, like anything like that. So I did a lot of that. I started therapy, not cognitive behavioral therapy or DBT, nothing like that. It's British object relational therapy, which is a very specific type where you work through your relationships with people with your therapist, in that the therapist can become like your brother or your father. Like the relationships that you have throughout your life are enacted, not like let's play act, not like that. Like you sit there and you have a therapeutic relationship with this person, but he's able to take care of you in ways that your caretakers never could, or that you've never had a relationship partner show up for you in. All emotional support and connection. And like some of the stuff that my therapist has worked on with me is stuff like me thinking like, I want to go do this bad thing, right? I want to go do it. And like, I'm worried that I'm going to make this decision and do all this. And he's like, you know, Savannah, if you do, I'll still be here and we'll still work through it. And it like blew my mind that just because I made a decision, I wasn't going to destroy everything, and that someone would still be there to support me and care for me past that. So stuff like that, like realizing that what I had experienced both as a child all the way through, you know, abusive relationships, like I was able to get through them, and I am in such a good spot now. It is amazing how much my life is better. The support that I have, all of my relationships are amazing. All of like the things that I do every day, like I'm excited about, you know, my cup of coffee in the morning, like knowing what I felt like for the majority of my life and knowing I don't have to be like that anymore. I just feel so grateful every single day for being able to be happy. And I am currently a federal employee for the Department of Defense. I work for the Navy, and my position currently is the deputy lead systems engineer for Surface, which means every ship and shore in the world, their network communications. I think I'm going to be transitioning away from that soon onto newer things. But I don't know. Like, my career has been fantastic. I've done a lot of really cool things. I, you know, worked on unmanned aircraft for 6 years and really loved that and being the network lead there. So got my master's degree. I would love to go back to school to become a therapist to help people, actively look at like alternative medicine types of psilocybin to help complex PTSD for everyone, not just veterans, for anyone that has experienced trauma, because there is a way to get out of it. And we need support and kindness and love, and our relationships with people are what gets us through things. My book is everywhere. It's on Amazon. It's on, goodness, Audible, narrated by myself. It's in Barnes & Noble. It's always at Oceanside unless it gets sold out. I have, you know, a website that you can go through. I have a blog. If you just Google Corporal Cannon, like a female Marine in Afghanistan, or just Corporal Cannon, it'll show up, or my name. It has all the links there. It's been an interesting experience having published this book. The feedback has been mostly phenomenal about, you know, understanding that there's war, especially, is not black and white. Like, everyone is flawed and we are all just trying to make it to the end and make it okay. I've gotten some negative feedback too. The people that were in Afghanistan who have read the book, there was a staff sergeant who was there at the time, and he's had me on his podcast, and he's talked to me since. He's now a warrant officer, Chief Warrant Officer Ballou. He's been phenomenal about it too, and he actually apologized to me for not seeing what was happening. And he was like, you know, read. He's like, everyone needs to read this. All leaders need to read this book to understand like what is going on in like their command, and they might not realize it's happening. And he, yeah, his apology like sent home a lot. So it's pretty good. Know that if you are struggling, you can definitely get better, and it'll be a hard road, but it is 100% worth it at the end.